In short, and entirely unsurprisingly, the notion that a collection of biographical data about individuals could be structured so as to reveal the relationships between them was being articulated, if not for the first time, but then in new ways. With the later advent of the computer relational database software, the brakes were off. Large biographical lexica, like PIR, now became the first stage, or even a byproduct of prosopography. Second stage, in which the data are structured for interrogation in a range of different ways, often statistical, leading to more quantitative and positivistic analyses, is now seen as at least desirable. It's important to emphasise that although prosopography now has a recognisable physiognomy, as it were, each attempt at one is distinct in that of necessity. It'll use different sources to ask different questions about different groups. Any group can be investigated so long as it's clearly defined by the researcher, and the sources of whatever sort yield data at least sufficient to demonstrate that the members of the group are connected in some way. The method no longer privileges social elites as the earliest did. Studies of people from all walks of life, however humble, are possible provided that the sources are sufficient to permit the creation of an intelligible data set. All available sources of whatever type should be used. Although prosopography can help to compensate for scarce data, if they are too lacunary or make the individualisation of each entity in the data set impossible, then the study cannot proceed. By the time of Stone's famous definition in 1971, prosopography was already well embarked on an almost viral spread throughout all historical periods. And this continues up to the present, and has, of course, been greatly facilitated by similar but unrelated initiatives began elsewhere. Amongst them, Louis Namier's 1927 study of the English Parliament of the 18th century, following Charles Beard's 1927 study of the rise of American civilization. In short, and entirely unsurprisingly, the notion that a collection of biographical data about individuals could be structured so as to reveal the relationships between them was being articulated, if not for the first time, but then in new ways. With the later advent of the computer relational database software, the brakes were off. Large biographical lexica, like PIR, now became the first stage, or even a byproduct of prosopography. A second stage, in which the data are structured for interrogation in a range of different ways, often statistical, leading to more quantitative and positivistic analyses, is now seen as at least desirable. It's important to emphasise that although prosopography now has a recognisable physiognomy, as it were, each attempt at one is distinct in that of necessity. It'll use different sources to ask different questions about different groups. Any group can be investigated so long as it's clearly defined by the researcher, and the sources of whatever sort yield data at least sufficient to demonstrate that the members of the group are connected in some way. The method no longer privileges social elites as the earliest did. Studies of people from all walks of life, however humble, are possible provided that the sources are sufficient to permit the creation of an intelligible data set. All available sources of whatever type should be used. Although prosopography can help to compensate for scarce data, if they are too lacunary or make the individualisation of each entity in the data set impossible, then the study cannot proceed. By the time of Stone's famous definition in 1971, prosopography was already well embarked on an almost viral spread throughout all historical periods. And this continues up to the present, and has, of course, been greatly facilitated by near universal use of the computer. In encountering the modern period, indeed contemporary history, it formed an alliance with sociological ideas pioneered by Pierre Bourdieu, which has led to some important new insights and refinements, and to the development of geometric data analysis. Prosopography is a collection of structured biographical data about a group of persons between whom there is more than one connection. The individuality of each person is preserved, but the primary object of study is the position and function of each person as the part of a wider social whole. At a time of great experimentation, the importance of genealogy amongst the ties that bind has not been overlooked, even if it can prove tricky, as this project on the land of the Normans discovered. But people do not belong to self-limiting groups. their connections extend out to members of other groups. Hence, the idea of networks or overlapping groups has become very important. Social network analysis is now an important supplementary tool for investigating a prosopographical corpus. Pioneering work has been done by Byzantinist Giovanni Ruffini and has also been explored in an archaeological context of ancient Rome by Sean Graham. An ambitious Portuguese project, I've managed to get the slides in the wrong direction, never mind. Is exploring the intricate networks built by, do you know this site at all? This is the front page, if you actually go to the Portuguese one, this is actually investigating the intricate networks built by merchant and financier Simon Ruiz, and apologies to any Portuguese here, who traded in Western Europe and the West Indies in the 16th century. If I just sort of scroll down to give you an idea of what they're up to, this is the man himself and his various connections. They are doing this on the basis of two groups of things, commercial letters and bills of exchange, both of which are shown on this site. It incorporates social network analysis, and it's using a piece of software which is an elaboration of, it's an elaboration of Manfred Tallow's CLIO system, which was developed in the 1960s or 70s, which models micro-historical projects that include prosopography based on the marking out of full source texts. Prosopography can't be meaningfully defined without reference to biography, directly or indirectly, a collective study of their lives in the famous definition, but it merely exploits structured biographical data rather than seeks to create a biography. The proliferation of overlapping terminology such as biography, collective biography, group biography, applied in quite different ways by biographers, whether from the literary or historical wing, and prosopographers of different periods, continues to prove extremely unhelpful. Barbara Kane makes some fundamentally important points as a biographer and historian, distinguishing between collective biography, group biography, and prosopography, which in her view is impossible to accept as part of a biographical enterprise. But neither is it possible nor helpful to banish biography entirely from prosopography. I'm not going to reverse direction, I think. Or maybe not.
Just minimise that.
Oh wait, it's hardly matters anyway. Yes, so, thank you. Sorry, it was a little bit of fun that I had in my article in that book. But it's neither possible nor helpful to banish biography entirely from prosopography. We are, after all, structuring often exiguous biographical data on persons whose individuality and identity are both carefully sought and maintained in the process, to quote Paul Magdaleno. Alison Booth in Virginia has even pioneered a digital prosopography in which the prosopographical population is composed of collections of biographical studies of women. This is an interesting idea. So attractive has the notion and use of prosopography become that one can encounter it in unexpected places. Bob Reinalda has recently suggested that a traditional biographical dictionary, suitably designed, can help to close the gap between the theory of international relations and its practice, by studying in particular the secretaries general of such organisations. More strikingly still, Stephen Paling, a professor of library and information studies at Wisconsin, has recently published a paper entitled Prosopography and the Organisation of Literary Works Towards a New Paradigm. In this, he describes the problems faced by librarians when trying to catalogue the contents of a work of fiction. Nothing, it seems, that librarians have so far come up with has satisfied the needs of their readers. Time then, he says, to ask not a typical question such as, what can we do with the tools we have, but what tools do we need to have in the first place? His paper posits for further exploration of the prosopographic paradigm, and he wishes to change the notion that central to prosopography are the concepts of individuals and groups or networks to a broader definition comprising networks of people, works and publications. Perhaps this diversity should not be surprising. The discipline of history has itself changed greatly in recent years. Peter Burke, for example, has charted the process by which, after a long period of mutual hostility and standoff, historians and social anthropologists began to realise that they could learn from each other. As he put it, in the last generation or so, the universe of historians has been expanding at a dizzying rate. Clearly, the idea of prosopography is portable and extensible, possibly suffering from an identity crisis. A very clear exposition in an encyclopedia entry from 2001 by Christoph Schaal ends by suggesting the notion of comparative prosopography. That's to say, with prosopographies becoming ever larger and expanding further and further into different societies through time and space, it becomes possible to consider comparing one with another, or several, a sort of prosopography of prosopographies. This in turn brings us to the web of data. The daisy chaining of multiple, I just plundered this from Wikipedia, I don't really know what it is. The daisy chaining of multiple projects, or the inclusion of all network related data into one huge data bank, like the fledgling product project directed by Will Handley at Florida State University. For a medievalist such as myself, whose sources are usually Latin texts relating to a very small section of society, the haves rather than the have-nots, what I referred to is at the start as the basics are of prime importance, and to me they're very simple. They relate to identity, that I've always sort of mentioned this before, the distinction between the name records and taking them into people. You've got, that's the first thing. The second thing is context. And for me, it's very important that if you're going to analyse groups of people, especially in these periods where data is very difficult to come by, you need the context. That is what makes sense of the records that you extract for analysis to seek identities of people, the discrete members of the population that you've got. And that requires text. Normally text. I mean, a medievalist is always text. There can be other things, but that presenting the source preserves the context. And then it's an issue of content. To be effectively exploited, to be used both to frame and answer questions, data must first be structured. That structure lies best between the heterogeneity of too much splitting and the homogeneity of too much lumping. And for me, that comes down to beware of micro-analysis, splitting things into ever smaller categories, which in the end swamp your sources with so much analysis before you've even started, that you are in danger of messing things up right from the beginning. Now, the problem with a lot of historical data is that it's incomplete or fuzzy. I worked on the project which is now just finishing its follow-on stage at Queen Mary London. It's called Who Were the Nuns? And I went to work with them on count. Hang on, why didn't it link? It should have linked to the net. Do I have to press control?
Try sort of hovering it around a little bit in the area of the... There it is, until you see the little hand.
Right.
So just... Oh, up.
Up.
Ah, yes, okay. Good. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Can we have it larger?
Yes, it's already...
Oh, right,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's as big as it gets, unfortunately.
Is it okay?
Maximise,
right.
Yep, hit that.
Maximise, yep, hit
yeah.
That, okay.
Yeah. There we go.
Right. Now, this gives a little bit down here, tells you a little bit about it. we've already been talking a lot about religious problems. Our project actually runs from 1600 to 1800, and during that time it wasn't possible to be a Catholic openly. There were all sorts of problems that you faced if you were. And a lot of women during that time wanted to fly the flag for English Catholicism by entering a religious house. They couldn't do it in England, so they founded a series of houses on the continent, mostly in northern France and Flanders. This becomes a very interesting phenomenon because these women had a very strong religious faith. There's very little evidence for any sort of coercion or what have you. They were actually doing something they believed in on a religious basis. They were preserving a particular idea of Catholicism, waiting for the time when it could be taken back home. And in fact, there was a very long wait. And what in the end made it possible for them to go home was the French Revolution. Their lives were in danger, they were allowed back, and they were quietly allowed to reform their communities. And in fact, Catholic emancipation was not too long behind. Now, these were technically enclosed convents, although the authorities always insisted that they were placed in the middle of town so they could be kept an eye on. The interesting thing about them is that they do form a series of connected communities in more ways than one. They have patrons both in England and on the continent that are very important. They are educators. They have a considerable cultural importance. Now, we weren't able to do much on that level in the project because, in fact, everything else turned out to be so rich. But one of the things that does link them, of course, is they, because you've got this small group of these sort of dissident Catholic families, they are inevitably interrelated. And that has led to some, you know, very interesting phenomenon. But one of the things about this is that we wanted to build into it the possibility of being able to analyse what the data are telling us. But at the same time, we have this problem, as all things do, is that you've got some sources which are much, much richer than others. So we developed a way around that by selecting a series of questions that we could ask based on those data sets which were particularly rich. So we've got this little section here where we have selected those sources which are particularly rich, and we have shown the sorts of questions that you can ask and see what you can get out of it. Now, we have quite a lot of nearly nuns, as we call them. These are women who left before taking final vows, and we've got graphs which show you the reason for this. Very often we don't know. Sometimes it's lack of money. They have to have a dowry when they come because that's how they're going to fund their career. And this is another interesting thing about these women, is that it's a religious decision, but it's also, there's something very empowering for these women. It's strange to as it may seem, they actually had in some ways much more autonomous and sort of fulfilling lives in this very severe drill of their order, their vows in these houses, than they might have had if they been at home, because they would have been controlled by men and not allowed an opinion. This is not true of the women in the convents, and they had a quite remarkable freedom when you think it's full of paradoxes, this particular thing. Anyway, sometimes actually what happens is that they go leave from one place, and before you know it, they turn up at another. Often they are ill, they're weak, so they're regarded as unsuitable, but they go away and somehow get healthier. They enter a different convent. So that's sometimes what we have to watch out for, is seeing who's who. This is a quick look at the what we know about social distribution. Again, the trouble is you've always got a big other category, but we can have a quick look at the different orders. The Augustinians are one of the less austere orders. In this case, I think we can probably say that they're sort of middle-ranking social status for the most part. You would expect, if you went to the Benedictines, and the biggest house was at Ghent, you would expect really normally that the Benedictines are the sort of aristocrats of the system. These are the houses that have a higher percentage of choir nuns amongst their professed members. They come from a very good family. And this is a breakdown of the numbers and so on. We decided to take, when we were looking at the geographic thing, just a few regions which are particularly well evidenced. This map is a rather misleading impression of, they came from everywhere. But these particular regions are particularly well evidenced in the data collection. Odd little things, this one, I think it's this, this is a thing of all convents. The northeast, time and time again, comes out very strongly, and sometimes in a different way. In the Sepulchrines, it's very noticeable that most of the lay sisters come from the northeast, though they've got a much wider geographical distribution amongst the choir nuns, and so on and so forth. So that was how we handled the thing there. But the main data set is searched by through the search button. And the thing here is that we can search by individual. I'm going to try some here, some ones I've already worked out so that I don't waste time trying to find things. This is a family based in Norfolk that produced a very large number of nuns. It was gentry. But it's very well connected. If I choose this particular nun, maybe. So it's her here. Well, all right, this one will do. I've got one here. This one is Mary Bedingfield. I'll give her name and religion. Breakdown of the fields, they're the basic biographical data. Now what we've done with each of the convents, we have on the same site a full transcript of one of the printed sources about each of these communities. A lot, the majority of the stuff we've used is actually still in, it was still in manuscript. Due to our indefatigable leader, Dr. Caroline Bowden, a lot of it has now been published at the end of the project. But it was, when we were working on it, actually manuscript. But for the ones that we were able to, we put online, and we actually show where these women appear in those particular sources, some of which are very, very interesting. This is an obituary from the Ghent Benedictines, which tend to give overview of the spiritual life as well as the conventual life of the lady in question. By far the most interesting of these sources, which is being edited by somebody outside the project, is from the Augustinians of Bruges, which is Frank verging on the indiscreet. We have some wonderful things from that, but unfortunately we haven't been able to incorporate it. So if I go back to this, what we've also done, and it is me that has done this actually, is to produce, now this you're not going to be able to see because it's too small. How do I?
I think there's a little zoom. If you put the mouse towards the bottom, a little plus sign. Move the mouse towards the bottom of the screen. There we are.
Oh, right.
I think you see the little plus
sign. Yes,
button.
Okay, yep. Good. Yes. Yes, but I'm not sure. See what? You won't be able to see it all, but the thing is about this is that this way of showing how incredibly interrelated these people were. As you may have seen before I started this, there were three family tree tables in which the same woman appears. And that's because, obviously, we have both a natal family, or on the father's side and on the mother's side, and sometimes there are crossovers. And the, if I look at these in greater detail, you can see more clearly, the nuns are shown with their UIDs. Now the UID, for example, this one here is OB129. That means that she is a Benedictine of Pontoise, and gives her date. Now, but through this means, it's possible to look at these families and to see whether you can see any sort of pattern, whether the fact that family is in fact particularly supportive of Benedictines in a particular place, or whether they in fact have more wide sympathies with these. Because some of these women deliberately chose the most awful and austere order. The poor prayers of Graveline are incredibly attractive to some even very aristocratic women, but they were notorious for their very harsh lifestyle. So the point with something like this is that you can see, I mean, this particular one, if I now get it to go small again, so we can zoom out. The software, oops, too much. The software I'm using here is it's Family Historian, which enables you to do all sorts of things. This line you can see at the bottom of the screen is indicating how where two quite far-flung branches of this family have interrelated. And the same software will also allow me to include what it calls everyone. And that means it will show the second marriages of mothers, for example. Because in families, you know, the second marriages and you know, the siblings are very important, and they're very important if you're trying to understand how ideas move from branches of families. But most genealogy will only allow you to do a descendant chart, which can be very limiting. On the other hand, when you do tell it to put everything in, it becomes completely unreadable. And it was quite clear that we did need social network analysis. We did not have time. That was we've run out of it, so this isn't going to happen now. Now, how do I? Yeah, I suppose I
just minimise or shut down.
I think
yep.
No, I think I shut.
Yep.
That. Yeah. Right. I think we're probably late enough now, aren't we? Anyway, I was going to show you a couple more examples of what that's done. But the thing that occurred to me last night, I've always been very struck by the speed with which the names of the Jesuit saints were adopted by these women as names of religion. The earliest canonizations were, there are two canonized in 1632, Ignatius Loyola and Francis Xavier. They are used as names of religion by Benedictines, actually, from these, the earliest profession I found is 1650s. This is actually quite remarkably early to be adopting this, particularly to say these women are Benedictine. I started to try to use this to work out what the earliest uses of those names were, and I ended up with five women, all of them closely related, and it's quite clear, actually, that this is something that's sort of inherited a predisposition, if you like. It's passed through by women. We have the same phenomenon in the Crusades. It's been well noted that women who belonged to the family of the first Crusaders, when they married into families which hadn't participated in the first Crusade, often imbued their sons with the ideals of the first Crusade, and then you find that the second Crusaders, and so it goes on. And this has become very noticeable. And I think you've got something similar happening with these women. And I was struck last night that this, in fact, is what is happening with the early take-up of these Jesuit names. But the ancestor, the first person who sort of started this off, is not in the database. So if I, as a human being, take up of these Jesuit names, but the ancestor, the first person who sort of started this off, is not in the database. So if I, as a human being,